We'll have a fair amount to get through. We're down to number 9 on the notes. How can a desire be named a notion? It seems like a strange use of the word notion. It does confuse people until you get used to it. But he has 3 distinct terms, actually. And they mean distinct things. And those 3 distinct terms are notion, concept, and idea. And I should put it notion, idea, and concept in terms of the actual. Process, cognitional process. Notion is that anticipation that precedes and goes beyond every bit of knowing. It's what provokes you to raise questions. It's what we've been talking about all this class today. The idea is the content of an insight. So it's at the second level, judgment. Huh? But the content of that. And concept is the formulation in the inner word. Of the content of the insight. So he's got 3 distinct terms. The distinction here is less pronounced than the distinction of notion from idea and concept, but still they are 3 distinct. And the only thing that I'm concerned about now is that you get what he means by notion. We'll see more about idea later, and we've seen enough about concept already. Okay, the desire to know is conscious intelligently and rationally. It is inquiring intelligence and reflecting reasonableness. Simply as desire, it is orientation, without as yet involving any cognitional content or notion. Still, intelligence as obverse heads for the intelligible as reverse. So intelligence heads for the intelligible. Reasonableness as obverse looks for the grounded as reverse. So it heads for reasonableness, heads for the grounded, what you've got evidence for. More fundamentally, the looking for, the desiring, the inquiring and reflecting is an obverse that intelligently and rationally heads for an unrestricted objective named being. Were that heading unconscious, so if you had no desire to know, there would be an orientation towards being, but there would be no desire to know being, because desire is conscious, and no notion of being. Were that heading empirically conscious, like hunger, for instance, there would be an orientation towards being and a felt desire to know being, but there would be no notion of being. Just as in hunger, there's an orientation towards food and a felt desire for food, but there's no notion of food. And simply knowing food isn't going to satisfy your hunger. In fact, the heading is intelligent and rational, and so there's not only an orientation towards being, not only a pure desire to know being, but also a notion of being. So notion means intelligent and reasonable desire. Not all desire, but intelligent and reasonable desire. Next, can we go on? Yes, Robbie.
Would the difference between a notion and a desire be that notion is explanatory?
Well, in reality, there is no difference. I mean, the notion of the desire to know is a notion of being. The formulation of it in terms of a notion is explanatory. That's an explanatory formulation, whereas the desire is descriptive. Is that what you're saying? The desire is now. Okay, that's fine. I agree with that. But in reality, you can put an equal sign between the two. The desire to know equals the notion.
Explanatory self-appropriation. Yeah. That's the notion.
That's what you know. Explanatory self-appropriation gives you the knowledge of the notion. Okay? The notion's operative before you reach explanatory self-appropriation. The notion's operative whenever you raise a question. So the notion of being was operative when you were an infant and you were wondering what in the world's going on around you. The notion of being was operative. Because what you wanted to know, what is this? And that's the notion. So I'm wondering here if we might be getting into a confusion by saying explanatory and descriptive. You know, I want to be careful about where we go with that, because what you just said is not correct. That the explanatory self-appropriation is the notion. No, it isn't. The notion is spontaneously operative in all human beings. Whenever they raise a question wanting to know what is, what's going on, what's happening, what's the reason for this, and so on and so forth, that is the notion function. And it's the same thing as the desire to know. So our questions evince an anticipation of being. And that anticipation of being is what is meant by the notion of being. You are the notion of being insofar as you raise these questions. You are that. So a child who is incapable of explanatory self-appropriation, just as much as it's in Lonergan or Heidegger or Scholes or Aquinas or any of these people with their philosophical explanations. I think it's very important to get that we all are this. We all are an anticipation, an intelligent and potentially intelligent, potentially reasonable anticipation of an objective frame being. And that objective, the most you can say about it for the moment is what will be known when you reach a true judgment. That's all he's claiming for to this point. That's what you're after, that's what the child is after, as much as the seasoned philosopher. Does that help? Yes. The notion of being is all pervasive. Next. It underpins and penetrates all cognitional contents and constitutes them as cognitional. So first of all, number one, it underpins them. So all the contents, sensations, images, memories, strivings at this level, and so forth, questions, hunches, clues, insights, further questions, grasp of evidence, judgments, it underpins all of those. Without the pure desire to know, sensitive living would remain in its routine of perception and inclination, instinct and habit, emotion and action. With the animals that we know and with whom we can identify to a certain extent, the animals whose sensitivity is such that, for instance, it would make them into pets like dogs and cats, okay? There's a curiosity that is evinced when something new comes along or when there's something that captures their attention. But otherwise, without that, their sensitivity is simply in a routine. Perception, conation, instinct, habit, emotion, action. But what breaks that circuit in us and releases intellectual activity is the wonder that Aristotle described as the beginning of all science and philosophy, the very beginning of the metaphysics. That wonder is intelligent inquiry. It selects data for insight. We don't fasten on to everything. We're selective because we have particular questions that we're raising at any given time. By that selecting, it underpins even the empirical component in our knowing. Still more obviously, all ideas and all concepts are responses to the desire to understand, and all judgments are responses to the demand for the unconditioned. So that's what he means by it underpins. It's this, what was the language in the third collection? It's the movement, the tidal movement, okay? Underpins it all. Secondly, it penetrates them all. It is the supreme heuristic notion. Prior to every content, it's the notion of the to be known that will be grasp when we get there through that content. As each content emerges, the to be known passes without residue into the known through that content. Some blank in universal anticipation is filled in. not merely to end that element of anticipation, but also to make the filler a part of the anticipated. Hence, prior to all answers, the notion of being is the notion of the totality to be known through all answers. Once all answers are reached, you get to that point, the notion of being becomes the notion of the totality known through all answers. And thirdly, it constitutes these elements, these contents, as cognition. Experience is for inquiring into being. Intelligence is for thinking out being. But by judgment, being is known. And in judgment, what is known as being. Hence, knowing is knowing being. That the known is never mere being, just as judgment is never a mere yes apart from any question that yes answers. So what I know when I make a true judgment is this about this. It's not just mere being, but this about this. It's something about you or something about myself or something about, you know, me or whatever. It's always some particular answer to some particular question. Now the next part, I want to move to the fuller set of notes that I gave you from Theology and the Dialectics of History, if we could. And this means it's like the notion of being as the core of meaning, because Lonergan's own theory of meaning developed after insight, and I think it's important. I think it just highlights what he's saying here. If we look at the fuller development of this, the theory of meaning, and I've got a summary in my own book in that section that I photocopied for you. Of the same material that he's referring to in chapter 12, but putting together what's in insight with what's in method of theology. So we can look at number 11 first on these pages, but at the end of this, we'll turn to these other notes. Next, and consequently, the notion of being is the core of meaning. This whole issue of meaning, Lonergan refers, I think it's in Understanding of Being, actually, to the book The Meaning of Meaning, and a couple of philosophers found that there were 102 different meanings of meaning, and various philosophers and so on, notions of meaning. It's a very complex type of meaning. The notion of being is the core of meaning. This section on that in Insight is an important introduction to Lonergan's theory of meaning, and we will take one by one what he means by, that should be by, not to, what he means by sources, acts, and terms of meaning. But I'm noting here, and that's why I'm turning to this other account, that in Method and Theology he adds more material. So here he's talking about, formal and full, I think, acts and terms of meaning, whereas in Method and Theology, he speaks about potential acts of meaning, formal acts of meaning, full acts of meaning, effective acts of meaning, and constitutive acts of meaning. So it's a much more complete presentation. And actually, potential corresponds basically to experience and to a little bit of understanding. Formal corresponds to conception at the level of understanding. Full corresponds to judgment. Effective and constitutive correspond to decision. So that's just the framework for this material. So what I've done is to pull it all together. The two discussions from Insight and Method and Theology. So in the notes that I gave you, the reason for the staple appearing where it is that I had it automatically stapled by the photocopier and I had it been upside down. So that, therefore, the staple's at the bottom. But if you look at 572, first page, number 4.3.1, the sources of meaning. And I think we should just go through this it will give you that it's all of the elements in Lonergan's theory of meaning pulled together in a very short statement. For insight, the sources of meaning include any element of cognitional process. Data and images, ideas and concepts, So, okay, data and images, ideas and concepts, the grasp of the unconditioned and judgment, no less the detached and disinterested desire to know that moves from experience to understanding to judgment. Method in theology attains a broader sweep. Sources of meaning are all conscious acts. So you could start with dreaming, if you want. And all intended contents, whether in the dream state or on any of the four levels of waking consciousness, experiencing, understanding, judgment, decision. The principal division of sources is into transcendental and categorical. The transcendental are the very dynamism. So again, you're talking here about the desire to know, the notion of being, and the notion of value. It's one notion, and ultimately it's a notion of God. But it's as referring to experiencing, understanding, and judgment, it's the notion of being, the desire to know, and then that goes, that extends off into what am I to do about it, what's the right thing to do, that's the notion of value, it's a further extension of it. Okay, so that's the transcendental. It cuts through all questions. Okay. The transcendental are the very dynamism of intentional consciousness, a capacity that consciously and unceasingly both heads for and recognizes data, intelligibility, truth and reality, and value. The categorical are the determinations reached through experiencing. So at the moment it's these data, it's what's in here, it's what I'm seeing, hearing, so on. Determinations reached through experiencing, through understanding, through judging, through deciding. The particular things that I'm understanding, that I'm knowing, that I'm making decisions about. The transcendental notions ground questioning, answers develop the categorical determinations. So all of that sources of meaning. Next, acts of meaning. Acts of meaning are of three kinds for insight and of five kinds for method and theology. For potential and constitutive or effective acts are added to the formal, full, and instrumental. I knew I was missing one here. Instrumental acts of meaning that are given and spoken of in this section in insight. All right, so let's take them as they're presented in method and theology. In potential acts of meaning, meaning is elemental. This will come into my paper next week if you're able to read it, the whole notion of elemental meaning. Meaning is elemental in that there has not yet been reached the distinction between meaning and meant. The sense in act is the intelligible in act. You do not have actual sound unless you have actual hearing. Okay? There are sound waves and potential sound, but you do not have actual sound unless there's actual hearing. One is the other. The sense in act is the sensibility. There is not yet the distinction between meaning and meant. Examples include the meaning of the smile that acts simply as an intersubjective determinant. He always gives the example, you walk into somebody's room, you think, oh, nice smile on their face, you're okay. If they're scowling, you get out of there as fast as possible. The meaning of the work of art prior to its interpretation by a critic. The meaning of the symbol in a dream, for instance, already performing its office of internal communication. It's already doing it. Even before you articulate it, bring it to a therapist or whatever, it's already, as long as it's already an internal communication of body, psyche, spirit going on through the dream symbol. Further examples are found in acts of sensing and understanding. The sensible in act and the sense in act are one and the same. Thus, sounding and hearing are an identity. Without ears, there can be longitudinal waves in the atmosphere, but there cannot be sound. Similarly, data are potentially intelligible, but their intelligibility in act coincides with an intelligence in act. Otherwise, they're not actually intelligible until they're understood. Okay. So that's potential meaning or elemental meaning. Lonergan employs exactly the same wording in insight and method in theology to say what he means by formal and full acts of meaning. The formal act is an act of conceiving, thinking, considering, defining, supposing, formulating. And in that formal act, there is introduced a distinction between meaning and the meant. I mean this. Okay? I'm thinking out So I'm establishing a difference between myself and what I'm knowing. So there is a distinction that's introduced when I start to think things through. The full act of meaning is an act of judging. And in that act of judging, I reach yet a fuller distinction. I am, you are, I am not you. Okay? I know you. And there's a distinction then, because you're not the same as I. So there's a distinction between myself, the knower, and the known. But the substantive determination of what constitutes the acts as respectively formal and full is more explicit in method and theology. In the formal act of meaning, so in conception, in conceiving, there has emerged the distinction between meaning and meant. For the meant is what is conceived, thought, considered, defined, supposed, formulated. Okay. I'm thinking about the theory of relativity. Okay. I'm thinking about it, I'm trying to piece it all through. Right, there's a distinction then between myself as thinking and this puzzle that I'm thinking about. However, the precise nature of this distinction has not yet been clarified, because in conception I don't yet know. One is meaning precisely what one is thinking about, but one has yet to determine whether the object of one's thought is really an object of thought or of something more than that. So, in conception, we're still just thinking. But in the full act, one settles the status of the object of thought. That it is merely an object of thought, or a mathematical entity, or a real thing lying in the world of human experience, or a transcendental reality beyond that world. Next, constitutive or effective acts of meaning produce active meanings. Active meanings come with judgments of value, decisions, actions. I should do this. This change should be made in the Constitution. So-and-so should be mayor because he brings these values to the city or whatever. Okay? Active meanings, what should be, the changes that should be introduced in our lives. Such meanings are specified more fully in the treatment of the functions of meaning. This is a method of theology. On the effective function of meaning, meaning as effective, Lonergan writes, what we make, we first intend. We imagine, we plan, we investigate possibilities, we weigh pros and cons, we enter into contracts, we have countless orders given and executed. From the beginning to the end of the process, we are engaged in acts of meaning, and without them, the process would not occur or the end be achieved. And then, this is one of his most important points, and it's everything that he writes about the constitutive function of meaning. Social institutions and human cultures have meanings as intrinsic components. Religions and art forms, languages and literatures, sciences, philosophies, histories, all are inextricably involved in acts of meaning. What is true of cultural achievements, no less is true of social institutions. The family, the state, the law, the economy are not fixed and immutable entities. They adapt to changing circumstances. They can be reconceived in the light of new ideas. They can be subjected to revolutionary change. But all such change involves change of meaning, a change of idea or concept, a change of judgment or evaluation, a change of the order or request. The state can be changed by rewriting its constitution more subtly. But no less effectively, it can be changed by reinterpreting the Constitution, or again by working on people's minds and hearts to change the objects that command their respect, hold their allegiance, fire their loyalty. So institutions are changed when you change the meaning. The instrumental act of meaning, or I still prefer to use the phrase rather than instrumental to speak of the communicative act, because that's really what he's talking about. Instrumental has a negative connotation for a lot of people today. The instrumental act, or the communicative act of meaning, finally, is the implementation of a formal or a full act by the use of words or symbols in a spoken, written, or merely imagined utterance. Again, instrumental acts of meaning are expressions. They externalize and exhibit for interpretation by others the potential formal, full, constitutive, or effective acts of meaning of the subject. So if I write an article or I give a lecture, my speaking and writing, those are communicative or instrumental acts of meaning, conveying the potential formal full effective constituent acts that I want to convey and communicate to you. The importance of instrumental acts is highlighted in his treatment of the communicative function of meaning. When what one person means is communicated to another, it can be communicated intersubjectively, by a smile, by a wink, by a nod, artistically, symbolically, linguistically, incarnately. So individual meaning becomes common meaning. But a rich store of common meaning is not the work of isolated individuals or even of single generations. Common meanings have histories. Think of it. You can all identify with this, whether you're Jesuits or not. There's a set of common meanings that makes up the Society of Jesus. Those common meanings have histories. They originate in single minds. They originated in the mind of St. Ignatius Loyola in this particular instance. But they become common only through successful and widespread communication. They're transmitted to successive generations only through training and education. Slowly and gradually, they're clarified, expressed, formulated, defined, only to be enriched and deepened and transformed, and no less often to be impoverished, emptied out, and deformed. Thus it is that the constitutive and communicative functions of meaning, when conjoined, yield the realities of community, existence, the existence of the individual person, and history. Terms of meaning, and then we'll get to the core of meaning in this notion of being. Terms of meaning. In insight, terms of meaning, that is, what is meant, are either formal or full, either concepts or judgments. Formal terms of meaning are what is conceived, thought, considered, defined, supposed, formulated. Full terms of meaning are what is affirmed or denied. In method and theology, there are terms also at the level of potential and constitutive or effective meaning. Well, of course, the term at the potential level is not distinct from the act that means it. A term of meaning is what is meant. In potential acts of meaning, meaning and meant are not yet sorted out. In formal acts, the distinction has emerged, but the exact status of the term remains indeterminate. In full acts of meaning, there occurs the probable or certain determination of the status of the term. It's real, it's distinct from myself, it's not just an object of thought or whatever. One settles whether or not A is, or whether or not A is B. In constitutive or effective acts of meaning, one settles one's attitude to A, what one will do for B, whether one will endeavor to bring about C. So, leading to decision. All right, now the core of meaning. The point that he's trying to make here, and then how he will expand on it in method. Where insight would discuss the notion of being as the core of meaning, since being is the all-inclusive term of meaning, and so the intention of being must be the core of all acts of meaning. For method and theology, it would seem, the all-inclusive term of meaning is the good, and so the intention of value, because he's concerned, he's very much emphasizing that this drive moves beyond being to the good, to what should be, what should not only to what is, but to what should be. So there's a further step that he's emphasizing in his later work. And so the intention of value, sublating the intention of being, is in effect the core of meaning, although this expression is not used. So the core of, meaning is expanded from the notion of being to the notion of value. But the notion of value includes the notion of meaning, and sublates it into a concern for will-constitutive and self-constitutive proxies. Even when the function of meaning that predominates is the cognitive function, the intention of being is an intention of what is valued as the truth. So even there's a value that's operative as we're pursuing these questions for the truth. The two texts together, insight and method, thus establish the protean consciousness of the human subject. Protean means that our consciousness is polymorphic. It can take all kinds of forms. As the source of the potential completeness that makes the universal viewpoint complete, universal, we'll see that later. But we are potential, there's a potential completeness about our consciousness. And it is relatively easy to make the necessary transpositions to the later perspective and so on. Well, I don't want to get into that. But that I wanted to spell out and go beyond just what he gives you an insight about the elements and the acts and the terms of meaning and the core of meaning to the fuller picture that is present in the method of theology, but it is the ocean where I return that. five to four. The notion of being and its further extension into the notion of value that is the core of all of these acts. The notion, the anticipation of what is and what should be is the core of conscious intentionality of all of its acts and all of its operations. Well, the next, the remainder is just to take up these different puzzles that he gives in section six. So I think what I'd rather do is to take up puzzles that you might have in the 5 minutes that we're waiting. Questions that you might want to ask. Yes.
I'm wondering about what are the syntactical laws that are factual aspects of the coalescence of partial into complete instrumental meanings.
Could you repeat that question?
Well, he's talking about an analytic proposition.
Oh!
And whether or not that regards the concrete universe. Oh. And he says that a condition is linked to its condition by the laws, and these are syntactical laws.
Okay. All right, yeah, we should have taken... I skipped analytic propositions and analytic principles in chapter 10 on reflective understanding, so we didn't take that portion. So let me see what I can do with that. It's not the kind of thing that I... is as much at my fingertips as a lot of the other stuff. An analytic proposition is one that every A is defined by a relation R to B. Every A is defined by a relation R to B. But this is an A, therefore it's defined by a relation R to B. Right. Now that can be, statements like that can be put together in thought experiments that have nothing to do with reality. And yet, there's a truth about it, that if you've got an A, then you've got to have a B. And you've got to have a relation R to B. That's analytic propositions. Analytic principles are where the A and the R and the B can also be affirmed in judgments of fact. And so then you're talking about things that can be verified in the world of experiencing, understanding, and judging in the universe of proportional being. Otherwise, the only thing that pulls this together are a set of syntactical laws. Symbolic logic deals with the syntactical laws to a large extent, not exclusively, but to a large extent, the syntactical laws that govern the creation and use of analytic propositions. But you can develop an entire symbolic logic that has nothing to do with anything that exists, simply by the syntactical laws that govern the relations of terms to one another and so on and so forth. We will see an analytic principle for the first time when we get to chapter 15. I think that's the first one, the isomorphism of knowing the world, where not only is it the case that wherever you have experience, you have to have something that's experienced. And wherever you have understanding, you have to have something that's understood. And wherever you have judgment, you have to have something that's affirmed. Right? Every A is defined by a relation R to B. But each one of those can be verified in experience. Okay? So that every act of sensation is defined by a relation R to something sensed. Every act of understanding is defined by a relation R to something that's understood, and so on and so forth. And the isomorphism, the set of judgments that gives you the isomorphism of knowing the known, the parallel structure of the acts and the contents, is a set of analytic principles, not just analytic propositions, but analytic principles. Because while the definitions come from your definition of from your syntactical laws that govern the definition of the terms, still those terms can be verified in concrete judgments of fact. Not only is it true that every sensation is defined by a relation to, so that's every seeing is defined by a relation to color, but I can verify that I perform acts of seeing. That's a concrete judgment of fact. And when I see color. So then you've got analytic principles rather than analytic propositions. Analytic propositions can be thought up ad infinitum and have nothing to do with what exists. Is that any help at all?
That's very helpful. But then when he says that analytic propositions do regard the concrete universe when these syntactical laws are factual, aspects.
When the elements of what are held together by the syntactical laws can also be affirmed in concrete judgments of fact.
When the elements that are held together by the
Otherwise, the syntactical laws give you laws of thought, okay,
yes,
and only.
So all of mathematics is analytic. Is there any value of mathematics to the extent that it...
To the extent that the mathematics is also verified in data that physicists and other scientists are studying, and it moves beyond being simply analytic. It moves beyond what, in Lonergan's terms, and these are his terms, they're not the terms that are generally used, it moves beyond being just analytic propositions to analytic principles.
Mm-hmm. I see. So then you use mathematics then as an example?
Well, maybe one example.
But then the coalescence of this partial turns into the instrumental complete meanings, or?
Instrumental would be the communication of that.
Complete instrumental meanings, so that would be
Where are you with this in the book?
On page 388. So when he's talking about the coalescence of the partial and the complete instrumental meanings, is that like to use a mathematical proof, like the elements of the proof that combine?
Formally, every analytic proposition regards the concrete universe in as much as syntactical laws are factual aspects of the coalescence of partial and complete instrumental meanings. That's a complex way, I think, of saying what I was trying to say. In as much as the elements that are held together by the syntactical laws can be affirmed in concrete judgments of fact, factual aspects, and then the coalescence of partial into complete instrumental meanings. It would be instrumental because they're always expressed, they're always formulated and expressed. It's a complex way of saying what I think I tried to say in response to your question. I would rather say it the way I say it. I don't say that very often, but the longer it lasts. But most of the time, I wish I had said that. I think the way I put it was clear. But if you want more on that, go back to chapter 10 on the section on analytic propositions and analytic principles, which we skipped in class because I thought we'd come back to it when we got to an analytic principle, and that isomorphism is the first of the analytic. I think it's the first one that he features in his own philosophy, the isomorphism. So that not only is every sensation, every act of sensation defined by a relation R to something sense, but all of those can be verified in concrete judgments of fact. I see you, you know, and that's a concrete judgment of fact.
That makes sense.
Anything else before we go? I'm not going to finish the discussion of the rest of the material in this chapter because it's on the notes, and I think I want to get into the object literature. So next week, the matter material is chapter 13. If you've got questions on the remainder of this, we can certainly take them. It's chapter 13, objectivity. It's short, much shorter than that, but it's key. Just remember a lot of the rules. On the Berlin Wall.
He does.